Great Lives is a download from Radio 4. We hope you enjoy what you're about to hear. The Lark Ascending, one of the most loved pieces of classical music in the English canon, written by the subject of today's Great Lives, the composer Ralph Vaughan Williams. And here's a bit of festive cheer. I am going to say Ralph. If people want to pronounce their names Rafe, they should spell them Rafe. So for me, it's going to be Ralph, but not necessarily from my guests. Now, when this piece was first played, the critic of the Times declared that this lovely little work is saturated with feeling for nature. Its gently grinding harmonies are mild and smiling, like the English countryside. Is that all there is to Vaughan Williams' music? Today we'll be wanting to explore that and a bit of the background to his life and hearing a bit of his work too. But first, the guest who's chosen him as a great life. He's a critic, journalist, crazily versatile broadcaster on just about all radio and television networks, and the author of several books, the latest of which is Hope and Glory, A People's History of Modern Britain. He's Stuart McConey, and he's joined me in Salford this afternoon, hotfoot from broadcasting the Radcliffe and McConey show somewhere else in this weird Gotham city of a broadcasting centre. Stuart, forgive me, but I can't help quoting from one of your recent Six Music playlists, which features bands like Necro Deathmort, Paradoxical Frog, Noodle, Tweak, and Savoury Duck. On the face of it, you're an unlikely devotee of English pastoral music, except perhaps for the Savoury Duck.
Well, yes, I can see that, Matthew, but I want to subtitle what I'm going to say about Vaughan Williams today with Everything You Know About Vaughan Williams Is Wrong. Well, that's an exaggeration, but I do think that the received wisdom, as received wisdom often is, about him projects an image of him that's rather different from the truth. I mean, the quote from the Times there, I think, is a brilliant example of how people see one element of VW's stuff, the smiling harmonies of him. To me, there is underneath that in The Lark Ascending such a darkness, not a melancholy, perhaps, rather than a darkness, that to me suffuses the piece. And a lot of people have an image of Vaughan Williams, this great shambling bear of a man, a sort of Winnie the Pooh of 20th century music, almost, with his lovely tunes. And I had a conversation with a relative of mine, an elderly relative of mine, who listened to Classic FM, whatever that is, and he said, so what do you like then? And I said, oh, I like Vaughan Williams. And he said, oh, yes, he said, I quite like some of that light music. And that there is that opinion of Vaughan Williams, and to me it is not light music at all. It is some of the most profound and serious and often challenging may not be the word, but complicated and, you know, deep music that's been produced in the last several hundred years in English music.
When, where, how did you first encounter his work?
Well, I was a sort of autodidact about classical music through libraries, both through the Wigan Library in my hometown, and when I went away to college to do my degree, the library in college, and I would sit quite often for an hour or two in the afternoon and take, on the days of vinyl, put the vinyl records on headphones and think, I'm going to try and educate myself about some of this stuff. And I remember some of the first things I listened to were Bartok, Debussy, Ravel, Walton. And I remember these early enthusiasms. But VW straight away, as he does with so many people, affected me in a way that hardly anything else did. I could hear straight away the Englishness of it, which is always mentioned in conjunction with him. I could hear straight away that he was a uniquely English voice, but that seemed a world away from a sort of pretty or chocolate box or, you know, kind of Englishness. There was a very deep, an Englishness, you know, almost of Shakespeare or something like that of him. You know, I just loved it. I think the first pieces I heard were probably The Lark Ascending. The Talis Fantasia, which, of course, isn't a remarkable thing for you to hear, The Talis Fantasia, those great blocks, those great chordal harmonies that, you know, completely knocked me for six, and still do. I still just hear the moment of the Lark Ascending there again. I have to ration myself sometimes with listening to some bits of Vaughan Williams, the beginning of The Sound Editor Music, the beginning of Job, Mask for Dancing, because it actually physically sets something off in me that I will lose my train of thought, so, you know, becoming capable of rational speech.
It intrigues me that you should have developed this early and intense love of classical music, and in parallel with that, of contemporary music, of pop music and all the rest. Mm. There are people who follow both with the same passion and intensity, but not many. Why do you think you...
I genuinely think I have no snobbery whatsoever about genre or, you know, someone once said to me, what do you like about music? Is it the sound it makes? And that's exactly what I like about it. I love squeaky gate music and horse frightening music and that kind of modern classical music that terrifies people. I like the vibrancy and kind of life of great pop music like ABBA or Tamla Motown. I struggle totally with opera. Even Vaughan Williams' operas, Hugh the Drover, I struggle with because it seems to me to fall neither here nor there, really. It's neither a terribly good play nor is it terribly good music. And I think it's kind of, you're getting the worst of all possible worlds, I think. It's a slight digression, but I remember when someone first said to me, listen to Verdi's Macbeth, because I love Macbeth. I love the play Macbeth. And I realised I couldn't tell what bit of the play we were in because by listening to the music. I thought, is this a love scene, or is this a fight, or is this a soliloquy? I have no idea, because the music seems to be so much of a oneness musically, that declamatory. I thought, this could be, I don't know what part of the play this is. Whereas, the emotion that comes off of Vaughan Williams' music is evident. You don't need to, it doesn't need to be translated. I think it's like walking into a room that's got an open painting in it. It acts on your subconscious before your conscious mind has had a chance to process it.
Well, let's find out a bit more about the background of Ralph Vaughan Williams, the man. Joining Stuart and me in the studio is M. Marshall Luck, who's chair of the Vaughan Williams Society and also founder of the English Music Festival. I think Vaughan Williams was born into a celebrated, almost aristocratic family, wasn't he?
That's right. He, aristocratic, but also intellectual and incredibly creative. He came from the Wedgwoods on one side of his family and the Darwins on the other side of his family. And in fact, there's a lovely story that when Ralph was a very young boy, he heard about the rumpus that had followed the publication of On the Origin of Species and went to his mother and said, you know, what is all this about? And she said, oh, it's nothing to worry about, dear. It's just that most people think that God created the world in 6 days and Great Uncle Charles thinks that it took a little bit longer.
Did he have a fairly gilded youth? Obviously, this was not a family on their beam end or struggling.
That's quite right. He was born in the Gloucestershire village of Down Ampney, where his father was vicar, but his father died when he was 2 years old, and his mother took him back to the family home, Leith Hill Place in Surrey. A rather austere but nevertheless beautiful large house set in acres of woodland and grounds. And the young Ralph absolutely loved it. He used to spend all his days exploring, wandering the woods and so on.
Do you imagine, Stuart, that he just sort of slipped into being a composer? How do you suppose it happened?
I imagine someone who loved music from a very early age, from a child, heard, you know, the music all around him. And what's always intrigued me, again, is that we think of him, because from his music, we think of him as, if not a reactionary, a conservative. And again, nothing could be further from the truth. As you say, he was a Fabian. He was a lifelong socialist, maybe a bit of, I don't know if that's the right way of putting it. He certainly was not conservative. He was an agnostic, who had no problem collecting the English hymnal and things like that. He was a very I think it's the contradictions about the man and the humanity that intrigue me in a way about him. But he was in the nicest sense of the word, I believe, a ladies' man. In the, you know, apparently he loved the company of women and women liked him. He wasn't at all this rather sort of Colonel Blimpish figure that he sometimes gets painted. And I imagine, to answer your question, sorry, Matthew, that I imagine he was surrounded by music as a child. One more thing. I made a sort of little pilgrimage to Down Ampney, to the little church where his dad was a vicar. And I've got a tiny little amount of stuff about him, but not much. I thought I was expecting some sort of Vaughan Williams theme park. And there was a lady sort of brushing up, said, are you interested in Vaughan Williams? And, I think we've got one or two things of his, so yeah.
How did the music develop with him, then?
He loved music from a very early age. He started, I think he wrote his first piece, which was called Robin's Nest, when he was 8 years old. But folk music was an early interest of his. He went to Charterhouse, and it was actually during this period that he used to go over to the workmen on the Leith Hill estate and listen to them singing folk music and would write the tunes down. So it was in him from a very early age, but it did take him quite a long time to find his own voice.
You've both described a man who is neither snobbish nor elitist nor aloof in any way. He was very keen on folk dancing and folk music. And there's a story that once when he was conducting for the English Folk Dance Society, dropped the baton and joined the dance. Have you heard that one, Emma?
Yes, I think I have. And there are a number of stories of his humanity, of him mucking in with the people. And one of the ways in which he was so easily able to capture these folk tunes was by making himself so much a friend and an ally of these people. I mean, other musicologists coming along and trying to write them down would just completely freeze them with fright and fear. Yeah. But he'd take them to the pub, he'd give them a pint of beer, which, you know, he loved doing anyway. He loved that sort of environment. And they would just completely open up and start singing to him very easily.
He'd written the Sea Symphony by the time the First World War came along, so he must have had a little bit of recognition by then.
Yes, he'd also written the Talis Fantasia, which also, along with On Wenlock Edge, these are the first works in which you really hear his own voice emerging. Of course, one of the main things that Vaughan Williams was doing was turning his back on the Teutonic elements that had persisted in English music up to this time. It's true that Parry and Stamford and Sullivan had been incorporating more English, a more English sound, but Vaughan Williams turned English music around entirely. He wanted to bring back a music of the people. He turned to two very vibrant and important English roots, folk music and Tudor music, and he combined them with his own inspired modernism, his own visionary quality, and produced a completely new voice. And it's this voice that was coming out in works such as the Talis Fantasia, Sea Symphony, and so on.
That's exactly how I feel about it. I'm so glad you said that, because to me, the kind of classical music I think as a child I thought was classical music, that Teutonic influence, that rather bombastic, that voice that had not spoken to me at all. VW's not like that at all, has he? Now, you said there's a modernism, completely. There's a modernism at work there that it's always ignored. And they're just seeing this directness. But I sometimes think he gets undervalued because of that directness. In rather the same way that lots of people who make memorable work. Paul McCartney, for instance, I think is actually a good comparison. Paul McCartney is often undervalued, just in compared to, say, John Lennon, because McCartney's works are so apparently easy, so graceful and easy. In fact, it takes an enormous amount of talent to do something like that. And there seems to be that quality with Vaughan Williams, but a modernism as well. And certainly, to say at that time, I want to go back to English folk traditions, was quite a, I'd say, politically revolutionary thing to be, perhaps overstating it, but certainly in terms of the musical establishment, people thought this was rather worthless music, didn't they? The sort of music that he was embracing. They thought it was really low-quality music, didn't they?
Absolutely, and I think English music has suffered hugely over the years because, I mean, this whole idea of English pastoral music, the Cowpat school of music, as it's referred to, the reason it's referred to that mostly is because it's seen as anachronistic and antediluvian because it harks back to folk music. So this idea of folk music being part of English music has given it a bad image that has persisted actually up to this day. Absolutely. But Vaughan Williams, in his book on national music, he said that folk song is incredibly important and incredibly powerful. He showed that folk music was incredibly important because it comes from the people. He said it speaks from the needs of a nation. And because of that, he said it reflects the needs of a people. And it's the directness in folk music that I think he liked. And that directness and the simplicity, going back to your idea of easy music, is what gives it its power. And Vaughan Williams saw this power and he used it.
The work is so strong. But I'm trying to form a picture of the man, this still relatively young man, going off to the First World War, joining the Royal Medical Corps. What sort of a picture do we have of the younger Vaughan Williams?
the former museum went off, I think, volunteered as an ambulance, as a stretcher carrying ambulance man in the First World War. Certainly, like a lot of young men of his generation, must have been profoundly affected by this. And I wonder whether some of that rupture with the pre-First World War music was produced by his experiences of war. I know that, when you were saying about cowpat music and people saying of the Pastoral Symphony that it was cowpat music, he said, didn't he, that it was the desolation of the battlefields of France that inspired that music. It was looking at a moonlit battlefield that inspired that music, not a hedgerow in
absolutely. The Pastoral Symphony is one of the works that comes in for a huge amount of criticism. Vaughan Williams rolling over and over in a ploughed field is what one critic said, and like a cow looking over a gate is what another one said. But he actually told Ursula, his second wife, it's not really Lambkin's frisking at all, as most people take for granted. It's really wartime music. Mm. A lot of it incubated when I used to go up night after night with the ambulance unit at Equavre, and there was a wonderful coro-like landscape in the sunset. So you're right, it is wartime music. And again, this is another example of how misunderstood this composer is.
I hate the expression cowpat as applied to him, because what it is not missing is passion.
Oh, completely.
It has tenderness, but it has passion. Completely. It has bite.
Oh, completely, yes. I think you can hear that. There's a grain of the music, isn't there? There is a bite about the music. It isn't soft or sweet or banal music. And I get the impression that he was probably, again, a big, complicated man, in the sense that he was clearly a man who liked a pint of beer. He was a physically big man who liked a pint of beer and was apparently very flirtatious. But at the same time, you could see a very tender, very thoughtful man that perhaps sort of belies his big bearish image as well.
What direction did his music take after the First World War? It must have affected him, the war, profoundly.
Well, the next major symphony that he wrote after the Pastoral Symphony was the Fourth Symphony, and in this we see a completely different sound world. It's ferocious, it's dissonant, it's quite a wild symphony.
This is the one of which he famously said, isn't it, "I don't know if I like it, but it's what I meant."
Absolutely, yes.
That's a wonderful expression.
You can hear that, because this must have come after the first three symphonies, like a bolt, really, out of the blue, because you're suddenly thrown in the first moments of the first movement, throw you into this turbulent world of sound that's anything but cowpat music.
That's right. And yet it was incredibly well received. It had its premiere in 1935 with Bolt at the Queen's Hall, and there were standing ovations. He was called up to the platform time and again. The applause didn't die down, and it was generally very well reviewed. That's not to say that he had turned his back on his previous voice. I think this is very much just a natural development of the way in which his music was going.
He clearly was a restless intellect musically as well. I get the impression you could play him modern music. I get the impression he would be open to listen to pretty much anything.
Let's listen to a bit of the Fourth Symphony. You're listening to Great Lives on BBC Radio 4, where my guest, the broadcaster Stuart McConey, is the surprising champion of the English composer Ralph Vaughan Williams. We've arrived at a point now between the two wars where he's looking back on the horror and violence of the First World War. He is probably foreseeing the inevitability of the Second World War, and his music has changed. The Fourth Symphony marks quite a change in the way that he was writing.
I think of the, I don't know whether you do, I think of the Fourth, the Fifth and the Sixth as sort of the big central trilogy of symphonies that kind of have something of the period and the darkness and turbulence of the period about them, particularly the Sixth, of course. But do you see them as a kind of trilogy?
They're certainly referred to as his war symphonies. Now, as we know, he very much turned his back on that. The Times, when the Times notice came out about the Sixth Symphony, it called it Vaughan Williams's war symphony.
Right.
And he wrote in and complained to the Times saying, "I dislike that implied connection very much." So he very much turned his back on that.
Vaughan Williams' first wife, Adeline, died in 1951. 2 years later, he married the very much younger Ursula Wood. You knew Ursula Wood?
Yes, not for very many years, unfortunately, but she was a wonderful person. I mean, at the time I knew her, she was still drinking like a fish and smoking like a chimney. She was the life and soul of every party. She loved being the centre of attention. She had countless stories. She was such a vibrant and lively character, and she'd hold parties, and she dragged him off to Italy and France and Greece and America and all over the world. She also took him to live back in London, which he loved, because as much as we think of Vaughan Williams as a pastoralist, he was also a great lover of London, as shown in the Second Symphony, the London Symphony. So I think she revivified him.
Well, that jollity comes out very well in this piece of BBC archive that we've got, which is from 1957, when he was given a tribute concert at the Albert Hall in celebration of his 85th birthday. And he is here responding to a speech given by Sir Arthur Bliss.
Well, I can't tell you what an honour, but rather an alarming honour it is to have this concert of my works. And especially so when I saw old Beethoven frowning sudden approval. The only thing that made me comfort me was that he must have been pleased, I think, when he realised that I had cribbed by Satan's dance directly from the scherzo of his last quartet. If you don't know it, have a look.
He sounds very jolly. He must have been 80. Well, he was 85.
Yes, he was full of humour. And there's a lovely story that when he was up in Yorkshire with his cousin Ralph Wedgwood, they'd been walking all day.
Oh, these posh people! Why didn't they make up their minds?
They were covered in mud and dust and so on, and pushed open the door of the inn, and the landlord eyed them rather suspiciously, you know, these filthy, dirty, dishevelled strangers. And they went in anyway, and Vaughan Williams spotted a piano over in the corner. Went straight over to it, sat down, and started playing dance tunes. And a few minutes later, the pub was full of cavorting, dancing couples. The landlord was so pleased that he threw his own son out of his bedroom, gave it to Vaughan Williams for the night, and offered Vaughan Williams a job for as long as he wanted in the pub.
I love the idea of Vaughan Williams as pub pianist. Yes. On a Friday night.
And still writing vigorously in the ninth decade of his life.
That's amazing, isn't it? I mean, the later symphonies, the eighth and ninth, I love them. The invention in them, there's a sense of kind of mischief almost about them, and you think this is a man that well into his ninth decade, as Matthew says, and there's still this impish, restless kind of musical curiosity, often with unconventional instruments. I mean, he loved doing things like that, didn't he?
Indeed, yes. I mean, the Ninth Symphony has got three saxophones and a flugelhorn in, and there are exotic percussion instruments in the Eighth Symphony. And the other work that he wrote at around that time was A Vision of Aeroplanes, which again completely belies the idea of him as this antediluvian composer. Yeah. It's a terrifying work.
He was loved as a teacher as well, wasn't he? I mean, his influence wasn't just in his music, but in the support that he gave to another generation. And I think Elizabeth McConkie was a pupil of his. Now, McConkie's music could not be more different from VW's music, but from what little I've read about it, VW may not have thought, this is my kind of music, but was really supportive. He had an open mind about new kinds of music, maybe because he had been aware himself that he'd been so often misrepresented and misunderstood. And of course, we cannot overstate the fact that he's not Sir Ralph Vaughan Williams. He didn't, you know, the ultimate...
Must have been offered.
He was offered and turned it down, as far as I understand. People say for different reasons. I heard that it was because of the establishment's treatment of Alan Bush, the communist composer, whose politics he didn't share, but he would defend to the death his right to be wrong, as Voltaire said. Mm. And also he had a lot of trouble with this very institution that we're in. He sent back a commission to the BBC on more than one occasion because of their attitude towards other composers and their politics. So I think he was a very principled man. I don't know whether you could tell exactly what his politics were, but he was certainly a very principled humanitarian. He wasn't a grumpy old man at all, was he?
No.
He was full of life and mischief and twinkling in his eye. He was a great man, I think. One of the great regrets that we never could have met, because he's really someone I would have loved to have taken to the pub.
And as it's Christmas Day, we will finish with part of his Fantasia on Christmas Carols. My thanks to my guest Stuart McConey, who chose the great life of Ralph, or Rafe, Vaughan Williams, and to our expert witness, M. Marshall Luck. Goodbye.
On Christmas night, all Christians sing to hear the news the angels bring.
On Christmas night, all Christians sing to hear the news the angels bring.
News of great joy, news of great birth, news of a merciful King's birth.
News of great joy, news of great birth.
Thank you for downloading this programme from Radio 4. There are some 250 other editions of Great Lives available on the Radio 4 website.